looking at end-of-life issues across a spectrum of illness.
Can you transmit neurodegenerative disorders through blood transfusions?
Yet one more reason to use naloxone.
And treating binge eating disorders.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on July 1st, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, as I said to you when we were talking about what we were going to talk about, of course, I'm passionate about these end-of-life issues. And that's largely, as you're well aware, the result of my chaplaincy work. In JAMA Internal Medicine this week, they took a look at a range of illnesses and the care that people received at the end of life.
And over our 10-plus years of recording the podcast, we've talked about end-of-life issues from different perspectives. And I actually wondered, what new perspective could this offer that we haven't actually visited about before? But this was interesting because it focused primarily on patients who had diseases or illnesses other than cancer. When we talk about end-of-life issues, we typically think about a cancer patient. But there are many other diseases that are terminal and result in end-of-life and the associated issues, things like end-stage renal disease. That's why it's called end-stage. Advanced heart disease, congestive heart failure, or even advanced emphysema, advanced COPD, dementia, frailty, or a couple other issues. Are those end-of-life times attended to in the same way as people that develop cancer? So what they did was they looked at palliative care consults, how often do not resuscitate or DNR orders were administered, inpatient hospital deaths, death in patient hospices, and death in intensive care units, and also the family reported end-of-life care. And what they discovered in over 57,000 different decedents, about half of whom had end-stage renal disease, congestive heart failure, or frailty, that they were much less likely to receive palliative care consultations. Only about half of them did versus three-fourths of patients that had cancer. They were more likely to die in the intensive care unit, less likely to be in a hospice, and the quality of the end-of-life care was judged to be inferior with those conditions as opposed to patients that had cancer.
In some respects, of course, this is not surprising because cancer is one of those things where we are faced with these increasing disability. We can see that the disease is advancing. And some of these other things, I think especially frailty and Alzheimer's, it's not quite as easy to look at those increments and say, yep, indeed, here's where we are.
I guess I have a different perspective because I take care of patients that have heart failure. We can see the decline in their health. I take a different perspective in that we've put up a lot of attention into providing good end-of-life care with cancer, and we've done a much poorer job of doing it with these other terminal diseases. So we've got a lot of catching up to do if we want to offer the best end-of-life care to our patients and their families.
I would offer you that I'm fortunate enough to work a lot with the palliative care team at Hopkins. And one of the things I hear from them is that there's a reluctance on the part of some clinicians to call in a palliative care consult on their patients.
There's no doubt about it. I would have to stand guilty as charged as well. We think about it, it really comes to the forefront of our mind when we talk about cancer care, but it doesn't come to the forefront of our mind with these other terminal diseases. That's why I think this paper is important, at least to bring it to our attention so that we can begin to have these discussions. And I wonder if it's going to change how you interact with physicians now in your role as a chaplain.
Well, we'll see. I would say that one thing that I definitely am passionate about is the idea that palliative care helps people to live the best they can with the symptoms they have. And so it's not necessarily an end-of-life thing.
I agree. We're all going to experience end-of-life at some time. The issue is there quality time, and are we receiving the best and most empathetic care during that time in our life?
Excellent message. From here, then, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine, and that's where we're going to stay for the remainder of our three studies. I suggested yet another indication for naloxone.
For our listeners, naloxone is an opioid antagonist. Naloxone is the treatment or the antidote or the antagonist to opioids. Mortality and hospital visits have increased 3 to 4 to 5 fold related to opioid ingestion over the last several decades. What this study attempted to do was they said, well, listen, what happens if you co-prescribe not only opioids, but also give them the antidote so that either if they get into difficulty or somebody they know gets into difficulty, it can be administered. They looked at 6 safety net primary care clinics in San Francisco. They reviewed almost 2,000 adults that were receiving long-term opioid therapy. About a third of these patients received not only the opioid, but also were prescribed naloxone. And what they discovered is that those who received naloxone compared to those that didn't had 47% fewer emergency department visits per month in the first 6 months, and about 63% fewer visits over the next year.
How fascinating. What about the number of people who actually used naloxone?
It's only now coming to the forefront. This is a VA population, and specifically the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has made co-prescription one of their focuses. So even in that setting, only about a third of patients were co-prescribed opioids and naloxone.
Sounds like a practice that's well worth promulgating. And of course, naloxone, I'm hoping, will not turn out to be one of these off-patent generic medications that all of a sudden we're going to start seeing huge price spikes regarding.
I agree with you. It's nice that this current study is the first to demonstrate both feasibility and clinical benefit. We certainly don't want to make it so expensive that we can't use it.
Exactly. Let's turn now to something else that's extremely common. More common, in fact, than I thought it was, but after reading this paper, I feel more informed. Binge eating disorder and treatment for that.
In our decade of recording, we've never talked about binge eating disorders before. It affects about 3% of the U.S. population and is characterized by recurrent, more than one time every 3 months, less than 2 hours, of psychologically distressing binge eating episodes. The individuals sense a lack of control, they consume large amounts of food, and by the way, psychologically, they feel terrible about it. And so oftentimes, these things take place in isolation. This is a specific DSM diagnosis. What this study did was they did a systematic review and a meta-analysis. What we know about therapy. There are two types of therapy. One is psychological, things like CBT, and pharmacologic. Antidepressants, especially the second generation ones, anticonvulsants, and some of the stimulants. Here's what they concluded. Cognitive behavioral therapy, if it's therapist-led, is effective. By the way, some of the medications do the same thing. Specifically, one that's called lisdexamfetamine, the only one that's FDA approved for this disorder, and the second generation antidepressants.
I had no idea, of course, that this was anywhere near as common as it turns out that it is. What's the association between binge eating disorder and obesity?
Well, it's interesting. I mentioned that binge eating disorder has a prevalence of about 3%, but about 25 to 30% of individuals with obesity have binge eating disorders. In those individuals that are being screened for gastric surgery, they need to be screened for this so it can be appropriately treated in conjunction with their surgery.
Okay. Good thing to bring into awareness. Finally, then, let's turn to this idea that somehow blood transfusions could convey dementia. Now, I recall, lo these many years ago, dissecting cadavers and being admonished to wear two pairs of gloves when working on the CNS, the central nervous system of a cadaver of a person that had died with dementia, because we might be infected with prions, these misfolded proteins, and they could be responsible for dementia. So this study I thought was really fascinating for the nerds among us, and I count myself in that group.
You couldn't have set up any better. This prion disease is clearly transmissible. And that's why either pathologists or anatomists that are dissecting individuals that have died of neurodegenerative disease need to be certain they don't get infected with prions. But there are other neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's that we don't really know the cause. And it is potentially possible that these are also caused by infectious agents that we just haven't identified yet. And if so, individuals that have received blood from one of these individuals would be at risk for also developing this neurodegenerative disorder. To address this, the authors looked at nationwide registries of transfusions in both Sweden and Denmark. And the nice thing about those countries is the entire population is well characterized with regard to their health, and it's put into a national database. They were able to look at almost 1.5 million patients who received transfusions between 1968 and 2012. After they received the transfusion, the donor subsequently would have developed a neurodegenerative disease. And the next question is it transmitted to these individuals that had transfusion? The short story is, it does not appear to be so. Among those individuals who received a transfusion, 3% received one from a donor who was later diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease, but it did not increase the recipient's risk of developing Parkinson's, any type of dementia.
I think this is really good news, and it's definitely reassuring. Of course, it makes me wonder whether the prion is found in the blood or just in CNS tissue.
Elizabeth, that's a great question. Maybe there's some infectious agent that has been put into the CNS system but isn't into the bloodstream. This doesn't address that question, but what it does address is it transmissible through blood transfusion? And I think this study would suggest that it's not.
Excellent, because gosh, we have enough that gets transmitted through blood transfusions, don't we?
And in fact, what they're able to show is that during this time period, hepatitis C was transmitted. A person who was truly infected and had a transmissible disease, it was in fact transmitted. The fact that neurodegenerative diseases were not suggested that they can't be transmitted by blood transfusions.
Very good. On that note then, of course, I am going to talk about the end of life issues on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.